Hey, welcome to On My Walk, the reading podcast that helps you capture some of those aha moments from reading and apply them to your life and to your leadership. Well, today I want to relay an incident in American history known as the XYZ Affair. And then I want us to think a little bit about how John Adams, our second president, handled it and what we learn in light of it. Namely, what separates self-serving leaders from servant leaders. Now, this is one of those little aha moments that I have enjoyed so much from walking through Joseph Ellis Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Founding Brothers. And by the way, check back tomorrow to On My Walk, and I should have a full review of the book for you by that time. And you can read it, and you'll find links to that book and others. I believe this is a volume that you will really enjoy. Well, back to John Adams and the XYZ Affair. Now, to appreciate how Adams handled this, we need to grasp the volatile state of American democracy in the late 1790s. I mean, it's not the fluid system we have today. In fact, it was so challenging that back in 1796, Thomas Jefferson said, "Whoever followed Washington was probably doomed to failure." Well, now it's 1797 and John Adams is president, and he's facing a crisis with France. And the more you look at it, the more it seems like Jefferson's words were prophetic. Okay, here's the situation. French privateers in the Atlantic and the Caribbean are making life really difficult for American shippers. What's a privateer? Well, a privateer is a private individual who has a commission from his government, in this case, the government of France, to capture merchant ships from other countries, in this case, the U.S. And so the U.S. is left in this very volatile situation. Should they declare war on France, or should they try to seek a diplomatic solution? Well, diplomacy, it seems the prudent thing to do, and so Adams sends a delegation to France, but they're rebuffed by France. And then Talleyrand, the foreign minister of France, sends three operatives, known as X, Y, and Z, to try to secure a bribe from Adams and the U.S. of 50,000 pounds sterling. Now listen, as Ellis describes the situation, the fallout, and what Adams does not do.
Both of these decisions paid dividends the following year, when the prospects for an outright declaration of war against France looked virtually certain. The ever agile and forever unscrupulous Talleyrand, foreign minister of France, had refused to receive the American peace delegation and had then sent three of his operatives to demand a bribe of 50,000 pounds sterling as the prerequisite for any further negotiations. When Adams received word of this outrageous ultimatum, he ordered the delegation to return home, but he also withheld the official dispatches describing the bribery scheme from the Congress and the public. Abigail described this decision as a very painful thing because the president could not play his strongest card. But Adams knew that popular reaction to what became known as the XYZ Affair after the three French operatives would be virulently patriotic and intensely belligerent. By delaying publication of the dispatches, he bought time, and during that time, Jerry, always the maverick, had opted to remain in Paris to confer unofficially with French diplomats about averting the looming war.
Did you hear what Abigail Adams wrote? The president could not play his strongest card. Well, he could have. Adams could have played his strongest card to vindicate himself, but he didn't do that because as a leader, he was not there to serve himself. He was there to serve the American people. And Adams felt that the American scene was too volatile. Patriotism was running so strong that many people would say, "What?" and they'd want to rush to war with France. But Adams, following in Washington's footsteps, said, "That's not wise at this stage. Let's try to stay neutral. Let's try to stay out of war. Let's try to keep the peace." So he says to the people, "Let's just wait a bit." And then, because he had two people in France, his friend Elbridge Gerry and his son John Quincy, Adams knew that France was slowly changing their tune behind the scenes. And with patience, they'd come around. So in 1798, Adams sends a second delegation to France to work out a negotiated settlement to end this quasi-war with France. And that idea was widely and wildly condemned at home. Now remember, Adams could have played his strong card. He could have come in and said, "Let me tell you something you don't know," and lay out the card with respect to the XYZ affair and the bribe. But he doesn't do that because he knows that, well, that would make him look good. It would potentially push the country into war. And so in what I think is a mark of great leadership and great statesmanship, he bites his tongue. He refuses to lay down that card. And what we need to understand is the political climate in which he lived, both at home and abroad, made or would make the desire to lay down that card even stronger. Abroad, both the French and the English looked at the United States as a little two-bit power, and it would be easy as a leader to say, "You think we're two-bit? Hey, let's take you on." But Adams doesn't go there. And at home, there were a number of things happening politically where it would be very easy for Adams, in a desire to defend himself and a desire to show himself the true leader that he is, to lay down that card. But again, he's unwilling to do that. And in the end, the delegation worked out a diplomatic solution, but not in time to help Adams, whose efforts in some ways may have cost him a second term as president. Ellis nods to this when he writes, "The fact that the decision to send a delegation rendered him unpopular, that it struck most observers as an act of political suicide, only confirmed for Adams that it must be right. The office of the presidency, as he saw it, was designed to levitate above the party squabbles and transcend partisan versions of the national interest. Even more palpably, the fullest expression of his best energies always occurred when the long-term public interest, as he understood it, clashed with the political imperatives of the moment." So well said. Leaders don't always play their strongest card. Sometimes they keep it held close to the chest and they bear the pain of not showing that card for the sake of the good of the people they lead. Now, earlier today, I was reviewing a verse from the New Testament scriptures from 1 John. And there's this verse in 1 John where John says, "By this we know love, that he, Jesus, laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers." Now, obviously, I'm not putting John Adams on par with Jesus, far from it. But his act illustrates what John describes as love. That is, laying down our lives, our agenda, our sense of recognition, our sense of priority, our sense of being viewed as a real leader for the sake of the brothers. In this case, the founding brothers and sisters of the young republic, who, with patriotic fervor, may have charged foolishly into war all over a misguided passion that could have been and ultimately was resolved by a more level-headed man so passionate that he was willing to take the heat for them. At times, leaders refuse to play their strongest card, especially when playing it will only serve them and not the cause or the people they are serving with their leadership. Well, that's my thought on my walk with Joseph Ellis and founding brothers. What you do with it, that's for you to work out in your walk through life.